Everybody listening to this, whether you like politics or you don't like politics, you probably have a vested interest in almost anything that's happening there. So right. Please pay attention and plan to vote.
This is the PMP Industry Insider Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome out to another episode of the PMP Industry Insider Podcast, where we take a look at what is changing in the industry and we drive. And those that are driving the changes, this is going to be a rough day already. This is bad. Yeah, for sure. As always, I am Donnie Shelton. I cannot introduce a podcast in case you're wondering, but I do own Triangle Home Services, which has Triangle Pest as well as Triangle Lawn. And with me is Mr. Dan Gordon. Dan, please introduce yourself, your companies.
I know your great
menu of companies, our sponsors, our outstanding guests, as well as our topic.
Hey, and Brett, our editor, note to editor, don't cut that. Let's have Donnie come up with his bumbling. Welcome this afternoon. Dan Gordon, PCO Bookkeepers, M&A Specialists. We do bookkeeping, accounting, and mergers and acquisition in the pest and lawn industry. And announcements. If you're interested in marketing, one of our sponsors is ColeMarch by WorkWave. You can visit them at ColeMarch.com. If you're interested in insurance, it's PestSure, and they do workers' comp, auto, GL, and a few others, and visit them at PestSure.com. And if you're interested in joining one of our industry peer groups, please visit us at PMPIndustryInsider.com/peer groups, or go and listen to us on episode 136, where we lay it all out. And those peer groups are actually, they're a lot of fun, and we're building several of them, or we've got several of them and we're building some more. So anyway, our guest today is Andrew Bray, Senior Vice President of Government Relationships and Membership for the National Association of Landscape Professionals. Before joining NALP in 2018, Andrew was the Vice President of Public Policy at the National Pest Management Association, which is where I met him. So he has experience in both pest and lawn sides of the business. He has a background in policy, advocacy, and political skills from working on Capitol Hill in a congressional office and working on multiple federal, state, and local campaigns. Longtime listeners may remember that we had Andrew on our podcast back on episode 13. Wow, in 2020.
Ooh, that is back there.
Where are we? We're at like 160s or something.
Yeah, that was in 2020. So there you go.
Shortly after the election, to talk about the Biden administration could mean for the industry. And here we are 3.5 years later in another election year. Anyway, welcome, Andrew.
Same damn candidates. Moving on. Yes.
We'll get there. Don't worry. I know we'll get there. But right. I do want to at least say, hey, you know, Donnie and Dan, it's great to see you again. I love being able to talk with you guys. And, you know, I'm not that far away from the pest control folks. I was talking with Andy and JD and Dominique with MPMA last week on some stuff. So it's always good to be on with you guys and talking to the industry about lawn care, pest control, or whatever we want to talk about. As I'm sure we'll get into some candidate stuff towards the end.
Well, it's great to have you on.
No, Donnie and I never, because Donnie leans left and sometimes I have to pull him back.
Oh my gosh. Yes, I am so liberal. It just, you wouldn't even know. Yes. So
left leaning.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. Oh, Dan, if he was close to me, we could probably joke him. But moving on. So, yes. All right, Andrew, let's get into this. So a lot has changed since you were here back in late 2020. COVID, I don't want to say it's in the rearview mirror, but all the freak out is in the rearview mirror. I think people are still getting COVID. But yes, so we're, you know, we talked back when there was COVID. We talked about a new president coming in. Let's get caught up. What's been going on in 4 years? So yeah.
Well, first of all,
what's been going on in Washington? Nothing.
Well, I would like to say I'm honored that I had episode 13. 13 was always an unlucky number, but my first son was born on the 13th. So I've changed my tune on number 13. So I'm honored that I had that one.
Fantastic.
When I was thinking about, you know, how long ago we talked, I got into my DeLorean and went back in time and thought how crazy it is it was. All we were talking about was, are you essential? Are you getting the vaccine? Did you get a PPP loan? You know, have you been forgiven for that PPP loan? I mean, the myriad of stuff I know we covered that time was very different than I anticipate us covering today. But what I would say is what is old is new again, because basically most of the issues that we were dealing with right before the pandemic are once again our issues, right? And there's obviously some nuances. There's been a few changes. But I'd love to go into to kind of highlight some of the key things I know that is pertinent to not only the lawn care, but the pest control industry.
Let's do it.
And I'd say the first and the biggie, gotta mention it. It should have passed last year, but it's the Farm Bill, right? And I don't know if you've had other folks on here talking advocacy or talking about it, but I just want to give a brief primer, very quick, high level. The Farm Bill is a massive agricultural appropriations package. And as you can see how dysfunctional Congress is, they can't try to pass one of these each year. So what they do is they put them on 4, 5, 6 year kind of deadlines, and then they jam all this stuff into one bill. And it's the Farm Bill for our industry. And you say our industry, well, we're not the agriculture industry. Certain parts of the lawn care industry can be considered ag. But for the most part, we're not agricultural. But what's important is inside of the Farm Bill is where they do deal with amendments to FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act. Okay. And let's be honest, if we can't do something about pesticides in some massive bill where it can get hidden and, you know, in the bottom of page 1,243, generally pesticide bills are like the third rail up on Capitol Hill, right? Mm-hmm. Because we can't get good Republicans a lot of times to support it. You're not going to get a moderate Democrat, and you're going to really stir up some of the people far to the left that just fundamentally hate pesticides, right? So this is our opportunity once every 4, 5, or 6 years to try to get some of our priorities in the Farm Bill. And just so you guys know, the Farm Bill is actually supposed to pass in December, but this is the way Congress is working right now. We were actually beginning to work on FY25 before we had passed FY24, which luckily did pass about a month and a half ago. So at least we can keep the lights open. And I only think that happened because we were in election year. But I digress. So in the Farm Bill, so what's our big priority, right? So our big holy grail, and this dates back to my time at MPMA, but it's the most impactful for the structural and the lawn care industry, is pesticide preemption, right?
Yes, preemption.
That's right. You hear it. And the thing about preemption, just so everyone knows, what preemption essentially means is it's a higher level of government preempting a lower level of government from setting policies in specific arenas, right? And so what we want to make sure happens is we do not like when a local government or municipality begins to regulate pesticides, okay? That is one of our biggest problems. We can all think about Montgomery County, Maryland, or Portland and South Portland, Maine. These places have eliminated the ability to use pesticides, but guess what? They have carve-outs for almost every other industry, except for the lawn care industry. Even structural pest control generally can get some carve-outs for public health pests, and especially ones inside of restaurants, inside establishments, inside homes for rodenticides or what
real quick, why is that? Why was lawn care not able to get a carve-out? Like, what happened?
So this is the way I can explain it from my experience doing it. And for some of the times, my experience doing it was I was more on the structural side. So I was just trying to get a carve out for my MPMA members. And, you know, that was before I was at NALP. And here's the way I would explain it to everyone. Okay. You got the agriculture industry. Everybody knows everybody's got to eat. Everybody loves the American farmer, right? So there's multiple avenues to basically try to prove we need to make sure we can apply pesticides, keep food prices down, make sure we can feed all of our citizens. And farmers are generally very sympathetic folks, right? You ever see them testify or go up and make a statement? They do an excellent job and they come across extremely well. Not saying we don't or others do, but agriculture is always going to get their carve out. So then you go down from there and you generally have your right of way. So think the people that are going to apply pesticides in and around railroad tracks or, you know, where you got electric lines running. People are like, yeah, that's a public safety. So of course that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So then we get to golf course. Golf course is always one of my most favorites because technically golf courses use a lot of pesticides, but they do so very responsibly. And that's fantastic. But the end of it is a lot of times there's a lot of fluid people involved in the golf industry. And a lot of times politicians like to play golf, right? So I'm giving so you my Mr. perspective. Gordon,
by the way.
Just
throw that out there.
That's just a theory that you
yes.
have, right?
Okay. This is my working theory. Please, I mean, I know this could be heard around the world. But this is just Andrew Braid's working theory.
Okay, that's fine.
And so then we get down to structural, right? And this is where the whole debate on public health, right? And you start talking about bed bugs and rodents, and you start talking about mosquito spraying, because even in the lawn care industry, a lot of times we can't apply pesticide in Montgomery County to treat a weed or a grub with imidacloprid, but you could still apply certain pesticides in and around homes if you're dealing with mosquitoes, right? Because it's a public health issue. So you get to grass or turf. And unfortunately, there are people that fundamentally demonize turf. Okay. There was an article that was out in the New York Times about 2 years ago that basically equated turf. Now listen to all the things it did. It kind of opened up and said turf is basically apartheid and slavery and brought over from England. I mean, my views. Okay. Yeah. But then they go on, and this is what they tick off. There uses too much water, right? Uses dangerous chemicals, right? You're using equipment that is putting gas into the ozone to cut it. Oh, and you're bringing over illegal immigrants to treat it. This is not me saying it. This is the article. And then at the end of it, there was a little video, and it was a skull and crossbones like coming out of the out of a lawn. Right? I mean, it's truly maddening. As somebody that fights these fights, because I always say, I am totally okay. If you want to have native species in your grass and you don't want to find turf that I'm lucky enough to have, because I have a professional that deals with mine, why don't you go have like two dogs and three young boys and tell me how they're going to run around with native grasses and rocks everywhere, right? I actually really value my lawn, and I think of a lot of Americans do. But that's kind of the fundamental reason on why we get X'd out a little bit, Donnie. Does that make sense?
Well, you know, you saying this reminds me of something that happened last summer, and I just now kind of put it together. Last year, we took a family vacation to the UK. I don't know if you guys have been there recently, but we did the full touristy stuff, right? And one of the things we did is we went to the castle in London. And if you know, it used to be, I used to fly out there all the time in the military. It was nice and clean and a ton of turf. Not that way anymore. It is overgrown weed field now. It looked awful. And I was like, what happened? And they're like, yeah, there's a thing now where it's just being natural and not yep. using pesticides or any, you know, herbicides. And I'm like, of course, I didn't say anything, but I'm just like, wow. So I guess for our listeners, it's not as far-fetched as it may sound. I was really surprised. Now, we obviously don't live in the UK, but, you know, sometimes
yeah. I kind of get. Well, I always, it's tough because these trends come over from Europe from once in a while, but what works in Europe doesn't always work for the US, right? Mm-hmm. Our nation is much larger. We have fundamentally set up our system a lot of times with larger properties. I think we've got much more wide open spaces. And there's a lot of times a native species should be used, right? But the way that we have basically been civilized for many, many years, the lawn is an extremely important part to our culture, right?
Right.
You think about when we were talking about COVID at the beginning, our industry did fantastic because everyone wanted to be outside and enhance their actual yards and their green spaces, right? So that's a fundamental value difference, I think, between folks in Europe and the U.S., and that's why I don't think we're ever going to go fully that way. But trust me, people in Montgomery.
Well, you just go to the north to Canada if you
exactly.
Think about it. With one problem comes another. You have the tall grass, and now ticks are going to be all over your kids because they'll be running around that tall grass, right? I mean, it's exactly. just this crazy stuff. Anyway, all right, I digress. Moving on.
Yeah. So back to the farm bill. No, I'm happy to go down wormholes anytime, you guys. Trust me, it's fun. So we've got this farm bill. We're trying to get this. We're trying to get this provision put in that basically would say, and this is really important because there's several competing things out there. We would like to make sure only states can regulate the sale and use of pesticides, right? So we don't want to make it so a locality can't. I mean, we want to make it so a locality can't, but the state still could. And this is important to know because our opponents are coming out and saying, we're trying to take rights away from states and we're trying to make it so, you know, these chemical manufacturers can put more products on schools, all sorts of asinine claims, right?
Right.
The reality is all our provision would do is say, look, if you want to ban a pesticide, you can. We're probably going to fight it, but we're going to do it at the state level because guess what? At the local level, emotion rules the day. The processes are nowhere near as organized. All of a sudden, a ban will show up the day before hearing, so you get almost zero prep time. The scale's so far tilted against us. I've been in some of those that you just get railroaded. It's just not good. And so we want to go to the state level, right? And about the school stuff, any state, about 36 states have some sort of law about, you know, how you have to apply pesticides to schools, whether it be a provide notice, you can't apply within this or whatever IPM protocol you might follow. Our provision would never change any of that, right? And it would never change the fact that in Montgomery County, in a locality, could still ban the use of pesticides on public property. We're just trying to say a locality shouldn't be making the decisions while private residents and homeowners want to do to protect their property and their turf and their landscapes.
But the whole thing's unworkable because you have a technician driving around in a truck with a route and he goes from town to town. And
yeah.
He doesn't know what to use, or he's got to
be
educated. So just to be clear, if this farm bill passes, is the Montgomery County thing is it dead at that point?
It is. My guess is, to play it out and knowing Montgomery County, I would not be surprised if they try to bring some sort of litigation to enjoin and try to move around. I would imagine they may do that. But technically, yes, whatever Montgomery County has done is trumped by a change to the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act that designates the Maryland State Legislature as the only authority that could make that ban.
Fantastic. I'm sure folks that are listening are in that part of the country.
Well, it's also interesting.
Pretty dialed into it.
Well, it's been a while since they've had that ban, and a lot of companies have made adjustments, and now you're going to adjust it right back, and you can't win.
I agree, but it's my understanding, and I hope it is not a member of MPMA or NALP or anybody else, because I have family in Montgomery County, that there is still prevalent pesticide use in Montgomery County. I'm just going to go ahead and say that because I said I've grown up in DC area. I have tons of aunts and uncles all through Northern Virginia and Maryland. And so I have two that live in Maryland, and I know that pesticides are being used at least on their properties.
Yeah, right. You just walk into Home Depot or Lowe's, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So preemption obviously is a really important part of the farm bill. And do you guys actually expect this to pass? And if so, then when?
So that's a great question. It's the million-dollar question I'm trying to answer every day for our members. So here's what I can tell you. The House typically goes first. And in a meeting with senior officials from the House Agriculture Committee last week, we were told, and I have now confirmed this with other folks, that they are likely going to move the bill out of the House Agriculture Committee the week before Memorial Day, if not sooner. Okay. But they have it. We want to get it out, because then that gives them hopefully time in July to try to move it across the whole floor.
Gotcha.
And that could be tough. The farm bill has to be bipartisan, because there's nothing that's going to pass this Congress that isn't bipartisan at this point, because you've got 10 no votes on the Republican side for almost anything. So, you know, the chairman, Glenn Thompson, is doing some really good work trying to find provisions that will bring over enough Democratic votes that won't dissuade too many more of the, we already know there's 20, 30 Republicans are going to just vote no against the farm bill, even though it helps their district. But I don't want to go down that path right now. It's very frustrating. Right. So we hopefully get it to move across the House before the August recess, maybe in September recess, because a lot of these folks want to campaign that they passed a farm bill. Especially,
I was going to say, I can't imagine it'd be very popular. Like, he voted against the farmers, and then they've got some dude, you know, who's just crying. And I mean, you know, that whole bid.
But it's
but how does it get out of the House? How does Johnson bring it? You know, I mean, his hands are tied. He can't do anything right now.
That's the only way for him to do it, which is why the Democratic votes are so important, and why, if you're paying attention this week, and I apologize if this is posting next week, you saw that he broke up the foreign aid packages into four different ones.
Yeah, that happened this morning, I think, right?
Right. And the idea is that you're going to have enough Democratic support for any of those that you could pass it on suspension, basically essentially having 2/3 vote of the caucus, which is a way to avoid this cumbersome rulemaking process where the Freedom Caucus have been gumming some things up. So the theory is we'd be doing the same concept of pass it on suspension with enough Democratic votes for the farm bill. The Senate, though, is a mess. And I have good friends that work in the Ag Committee on the Senate as well. And here's the dynamics that's really tough there. You've got a senator, or the chair of the Ag Committee, Senator Debbie Stabenow, is retiring. right? And so she wants to pass Farm Bill, right? This is the last time she's ever going to get to have this impact. And Michigan is actually a much stronger ag state than you would think when you really kind of look at some of the numbers. Tons of ag interest there. So she wants to pass it. And she is willing to compromise on some things, from my understanding. Now, Bozeman, on the other side, is looking at the Senate map right now and the Senate elections. And he's like, we're going to retake the Senate. I want to run the Farm Bill. I want to run the Farm Bill with a new ag ranking member when I'm in charge, right? And so
he wants to hold it.
He has significant motivation to hold it, right? And so I think we will know so much more when we see the text of the House bill and see what Senator Stabenow and Bozeman do. I've been told that there's a chance that once the House bill is out and everyone's seen what's in it, that they're both going to introduce their own competing bill, which if they do that, I think it's done. It's not happening this Congress. Gotcha. Now, if they see that and decide to try to start actually talking together, because they're not even really communicating that well together, which is not a good sign this far in the process, then we maybe get somewhere. But the tea leaves are really going to see what their move is once we see the House bill. But
just as we thought, that the Congress is always looking out for the American people as opposed to their self-interest, right?
They're looking out for their constituents. Come on. Let's switch gears here, because this has been, I think for most of our listeners, this is obviously a big issue, and I am certainly in favor of preemption. I think that should, meaning like this whole idea of local municipalities. Yeah. I mean, it's a nightmare. Anyway, so let's talk through. So talk about preemption. Now it's an election year. What is happening as far as like advocacy, and what's happening as far as what we're able to do versus not? I mean, and it is one wild. I mean, it is turning out to be. We didn't even got like. I mean, it's what? It's April, and it's already crazy and chaotic, as far as the elections are concerned. Can you just walk us through that just a bit?
Sure. So, a couple of things that I would when we're talking about elections. First of all, this is one of the most important things: is that everybody listening to this, whether you like politics or you don't like politics, you probably have a vested interest in almost anything that's happening there. So please pay attention and plan to vote. I can tell you, I know that at NALP, we will be putting out a lot of information when we get close to Labor Day to make sure everybody knows how to register to vote, how to absentee vote, because our annual meeting is actually over Election Day. So people that are going to be at our annual meeting, Elevate, they need to make sure that they voted absentee. Otherwise, their vote's not going to be counted.
Did you get a discount on the location or something like that?
So...
You guys are feeding the whole. Anyway, yeah, let's get. Yeah, yeah. I'm not even going to go there. All right, keep going.
No, I knew where you were going to go. I'm not going there either. I think what gets really tough. So it's very difficult, but there are opportunities. It's about poising yourself to be ready for the really quick opportunities and then the long play for the next Congress, right? And so basically, Congress will go home in August, and they generally won't return besides for maybe 1 week in September to pass a continuing resolution. Otherwise, they're campaigning from August until after the election. And in other years, that's a prime time, because that's when we're really kicking in the appropriations process. So we will be fighting like heck to see if we can get a farm bill, to see if we can do some stuff in appropriations on some other things, such as trying to get a tax credit on gas to electric equipment. And obviously, we're always very heavy in H2B, not as important to the lawn care side, but to the landscape side, very important.
Sure.
But yeah, the issue is they're going to come back, and we're going to be in a lame duck Congress. And that's like the silliest of silly seasons in Washington, D.C., especially if you're going to have transitions in all three places. And when I say all three places, if we're getting a different administration, a different House leadership, and a different Senate leadership, all three of which are very much on the table. I could completely see the House going Dem, the Senate going Republican, and President Trump, resuming in his office. I don't know if that's going to happen, but if you look at all the polls and numbers, that is all very possible. Right?
So just translating what he just said there for our listeners, if you think things are bad and nothing's happening now, just wait, there's a whole nother level.
That's right.
Level of nothingness.
Yeah, because generally everything has to originate in the House typically. So you think that a Democratic House is going to work with a Republican Senate and President Trump? It's not going to happen. So what will happen though there is the outgoing party in different chambers will try to take advantage or exploit the situation, whereas the party that's going to come into power will try to hold things up. Either way, usually it's an opportunity to try to get some things in. So a lot of this is about getting ready and knowing who's going to have juice and who isn't. You also know that you're going to have guys that might have been a champion that just lost their election. Some of those guys never even come back to DC. Others will be your champion for the last like 30 days and do whatever you ask them to do, because they're like, I don't care, I'm leaving. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's that that's the game we're getting ready for. But the long thing is we're really trying to identify who our champions are, right? And are there ways to support and highlight the good work they've done for us in our industry, so that we can make sure if our members are in their district that they're aware that this person was fighting for them. We can't politically endorse one candidate or another. That's not what we do. It's kind of gets you in a tricky spot, but what we can do is provide information about what certain people have done for the industry, right? We're not saying you need to vote for him or vote for him over her, but you can have the information. And that's what we really try to provide as we get close to the election season, so people can make educated decisions.
So I have a question, and if you don't know the answer to this, it's perfectly fine. It's, by the way, it's not on our outline, but I have to ask this question. So right now, as we are recording this, Trump is up in New York, and it is a show, right? Yeah. What happens if he actually gets convicted? Let's just say, I mean, I think he's facing like 34 counts. Like, does it have any effect on his ability to continue to run? Or is it like, is there a case here where somehow, some way, he's not able to run? I mean, obviously, I guess if he goes to jail, which I don't know if that'll happen or not, but let's just walk through that scenario. Is that even possible at this point? Or is it just like, well, even if he gets convicted, he's going to probably pay some money or whatever. And then, you know, we'll just keep going down this road as the way the election's going right now.
Yeah. So I think the case that's going right now is likely one of the, and watch, I'm going to get this wrong and it's going to be what sinks him. But I think this is probably one of the least onerous ones for him. I think it's a well-known fact that, you know, President Trump and his, you know, lifestyle has had extramarital affairs. I don't think people are going to not vote for him because of that. And the fact that he tried to pay somebody off. I mean, go look at what happened with John Edwards, you know,
Oh, 15 years ago.
Really similar stuff. And he actually got acquitted. He actually was never found guilty of kind of some similar stuff,
but
right?
There was never a President Edwards.
Exactly. Agreed. Yeah. So on that one, where I would say his biggest problem is what's being tried to brought forward by the special counsel on his engagement with January 6th. If that were to move before the election, which I think is looking more and more unlikely, I think that could be incredibly damaging. Right. But then you get into a question is, so it's moving. It's not going to happen before the election. He then gets elected. Because that was a special counsel by the Department of Justice, he's likely going to be funded and it's not going to move forward. But that doesn't mean you're not going to have tons of groups come out of the woodwork to try to figure out a way around that, which I will tell you what I think is the one to watch the closest, which will survive his presidency, is what goes on down in Georgia with the election fraud stuff. Because that's a state case and something that he, even as president, can't shut down a state level case. And so I don't think any of this, I think the one that's going on now will come out. I do think the Supreme Court is likely going to say he's not immune and those oral arguments are next week. Right. But I think the vast majority of the other ones, because of the ability to delay, and he's not doing anything wrong. He's using the legal system with how it's designed. It's a slow moving, deliberate process. Mm-hmm. I think because of that and the amount of them and his status as a former president, I think that we're not going to have a ton of resolution of this before you go to the ballots on November.
Yeah, and people who are going to vote for him are going to vote for his base. That's rock solid. So,
well, yeah. And my thing is, I was just curious if there's a scenario here where he physically, like, he's probably going to be on the ballot, but now he can't run as a president or something like that. That's the more like, okay, now he's a convicted felon, and is there some thing where it's like, well, he can't run now or whatever, and it's like, oh my gosh, we got to find another candidate or whatever, or it's going to be the vice, or, you know, who knows? I don't know, but it is kind of crazy. And the thing in Georgia, I mean, that's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
I almost feel like, you know, we're watching reality TV there. But okay, so back to the outline. I'm sorry, I was just curious as you were talking about that, like, is there a scenario here where he can't necessarily run? It sounds like what you're saying is most likely not. It sounds like he's going to be able to run.
Yeah.
Kind of however that comes out.
Well, so here's the deal. At this point in the process, you're not going to be able to likely pull his name off of ballots, right? Because you'd almost at that point be disenfranchising voters.
Right.
So I do think if at the 11th hour there was a conviction that basically could prove that he was an insurrectionist, but I don't think that's exactly how it'd be worded, you would quickly see the Democratic-controlled Senate move to do something very swiftly to make him ineligible, but it wouldn't get the support of the House. I think at the end of the day, what happens in these courts are predominantly for the court of public opinion at the moment to see if they will elect him or not.
Right.
It's not going to move the needle. It's just a big waste of time and money.
Interesting.
So, okay. So let's switch gears to away from pesticide and herbicide. Let's go to employment law. What are you seeing over time? What are you seeing in the way of labor law that we should watch out for?
Yeah, I mean, so we've been dealing with the overtime issue for many years. It dates back to the Biden administration. And for those of you guys that wasn't sure if you remember, basically, when we're talking about overtime, we're talking about overtime and we're talking about what's called the white collar exemption. And so it means that if you're doing manual labor, and many in the lawn care industry are doing what is called manual labor, if you work in excess of 40 hours, you're required to pay overtime, which is traditionally time and a half, if
exempt,
not more.
Non-exempt employees.
Exactly. So what we're really talking about is how do we see if there's people that are exempt from it? And it depends on their job roles, right? And this is called the white collar exemption. And the most commonly is used is like the administrative assistant that is conducting certain job functions that gives them some discretionary authority that makes them seem higher up than they really are, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this duties test, and it kind of varies depending on what your job is. This can actually be, and Dan, I think you know this pretty well too, this can be really impactful for how you set up your sales structure for like a salesman, because sometimes they can get wrapped into this as well. But the key that's changing mostly, and there isn't too much changing to the duties test, it's really the mandatory threshold of your annual salary, right? And so
that's what I was going to say. Your technicians aren't going to meet that threshold, or maybe they will, but probably not.
Yeah. So if you're under the threshold, the duties test doesn't matter. You have to be paid overtime, just like you're a manual labor. And so that threshold right now is around approximately $35,000, right? And so what was this? 8 years ago. I'm losing time. President Obama, when Biden was his vice president, wanted to propose raising that threshold from 35,000 to around 50,000. He introduced the rule, it was litigated, and they ruled that he overstepped his legal authority under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that didn't move forward. So here we are with Biden, and he's making another run at it. And I believe that the rule is likely to publish from the Department of Labor by the end of this week, or certainly by the end of the month. And the only reason I know that, when a rule is being promulgated, going through this slow-making, methodical process, the last step is whenever the department that is introducing the rule, if it's an EPA thing on pesticides, and this is the Department of Labor, they send it to OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, and it goes through this OIRA process. And it's basically the last look at the rule from the White House. When it leaves OIRA, we know that the rule is imminent. It left OIRA last Wednesday, I believe, Wednesday or Thursday. So that's why I'm telling you, we could see the final rule. And I don't expect many changes, Dan, to the final rule than what was proposed that we've known about for about a year. We submitted comments against. And let me be very clear, we're not against making sure people have the fair wage. We're just trying to make sure that's a pretty significant jump, right? From 35,000 to nearly 60,000. Yeah. And so we think for the most part, I think our industry is pretty equipped to handle this. I've told people many times, start looking at the job duties of anybody that you have in that $35,000 to $60,000 range on your staff. You need to be looking at what their responsibilities are right now and be prepared to either change some of their responsibilities or give them a pay increase, or be prepared to pay them overtime. There's nothing wrong with paying overtime. You just need to be prepared for it.
Mm-hmm. Is there a place that someone can look to kind of like figure out like, okay, if they're in this range, here's how this needs to be worded. Here's what, you know what I mean? Like, here's what I need to be making sure that's either not in there or is in there, depending on what you're going to do.
Yeah, there's the Department of Labor has some great resources. If you literally look up, if you literally Google Department of Labor overtime duties tests, you'll get some bulletins that'll pop up like from the Department of Labor. I am also always happy to help with anybody and one-off. I've written extensively about this, both at my time at MPMA and at NALP. And I think for any company that has an accounting department or HR department, they should have some knowledge of this. This isn't something new. It's just changing the threshold, right? And so that would be my recommendation, Donnie.
Yeah, good. All right, let's talk about state and local stuff. Any hot spots? I mean, obviously, I know employee law. We're going to have Gene on in a couple. Next month, and we're going to kind of talk a little bit about this as well as 1099s, which is a whole other ball of wax. But anything that's happening on the state and local level that people need to be aware of, anything you're seeing that's kind of coming out that we either need to A, advocate for, or B, try to kill?
Sure. So, I mean, we're in the thick of it, and Colorado is trying to roll back preemption. And I'm not going to harp on this too long because we talked plenty about preemption, but Colorado is becoming increasingly, I've started calling it California because it's just like California. that's been my new name for it. But because here's the thing. So I'm going to use California as my example because they're hammering us on the three issues that we're seeing the most in the states. Okay. So it's not just pesticide preemption, it's anything pesticide related I put in a bucket. Colorado is moving aggressively on anything anti-pesticide, but they're also going hardcore on water-related issues, which we are seeing increasing issues and efforts to tear out turf, to give you money back for tearing out your turf, to restricting the amount of turf that can be put on new built homes or commercial property, and this continued notion that there is functional turf versus non-functional turf, which we as an industry push back against really vociferously because all turf has a function if it's put in the right way and it's the right plant for the right space, right?
Right.
A lot of our opponents that don't like turf view functional turf as turf that a person walks on or actually is present on. And anything a person might not walk on is no longer functional, which we know is not true from all the sociological advantages, economic advantages, and of course, the plethora of environmental.
I have a quick question. So would that mean that when Dan plays golf, the fairway is non-functional turf? Is that what that means there?
No, it's a non-functional player on functional turf.
You have to walk on it to be functional.
Yes.
If you don't walk on it, it's non-functional. Yeah, so, okay, moving on. No,
then in that instance, only the greens are non-functional, right, Dan?
That's right. You can hit them everywhere.
Oh gosh, I love it.
But then, and we are just see, this water issue has really kind of started to pop up to be one of our really. We're working on some new industry positions and one pagers. So I hope when I come on next time, I can kind of articulate how we're attacking it. But we're actually having a meeting with our government affairs council tomorrow to cover some of this. But then the last one, and a lot of people have heard about this, but it is in full swing, is the effort to restrict the use of gas powered lawn and landscape equipment. Right?
Oh gosh, yes.
That is not slowing down. California's ban on the sale is in effect as of right now. Funny thing about
that for homeowners as well, or just okay.
Nobody in the state of California can use can buy gas powered equipment. Okay. So the way it works in California is all the stuff needs to be approved by CalCARB. And so they're not approving anything that isn't zero emission at this point. They did give a buffer zone for stores or whatever to get rid of their inventory. So, but here's the thing is you're never going to get somebody coming around and giving you a ticket for using something gas powered. You just can no longer buy it, right?
Wow. So now, if I go to Home Depot in California, I can't buy a lawnmower?
You probably shouldn't at this point.
An electric one.
You'll buy electric, but you probably can't find mini gas there anymore, Dan.
Wow.
Yeah, already. And then apparently, I mean, somebody can drive over to another state and then drive it back in, I'm sure, but that's, you know. How do they want to enforce that?
There's a business for you, Donnie. You get a tractor trailer, bring some.
I could be a dealer.
But you can't sell it in there. So you've got to sell something else. And the giveaway is the lawnmower, right?
Yep.
So yep. Something. There's definitely a business opportunity there.
Of course. But then everybody else is following suit. We're involved in some litigation in New Jersey right now. The association is in support of some landscapers that are pushing back against a ban in Montclair, New Jersey. And we saw several states this legislative cycle attempt to try to put in place a ban, but none of them did. We were able to beat them all. But the last thing I'll say about it that I do think is kind of funny. So California did this ban, and they're technically the only state that is supposed to be able to do it. It's a whole preemption concept again, but this is more federal preemption over a state level preemption because you're talking about emissions, right? You don't want to have 50 standards on what type of car you're going to have, right? So that's why the Clean Air Act's written that way. But California had this carve out, but they have to get a waiver by EPA. EPA has not approved the waiver, and there's a good chance they are not going to get to the waiver by, say, January 20th of next year. And let's be very clear, we have a Trump administration, I can assure you that waiver won't be approved and California CARB will likely have to amend their rule. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I just want to give a little context to that about, hey, why your vote really does matter.
Wow.
So tell me about the Montclair, New Jersey, because I during the summer, I live pretty close to there. What are they looking to do?
So we have always kind of taken this approach that we support a responsible transition, right? We want to move the industry forward as quickly as possible. And as soon as the equipment is there and the cost comes down and the infrastructure is in place, then by all means, we want to encourage our members to move to cleaner methods of doing it, right? But we don't think it's there yet. And so we had been very hesitant to get involved in litigation. But in Montclair, the town literally put something out in August that said they were thinking about banning gas-powered leaf blowers, right? And then in September, like it was like September 15th, I might have the date wrong, damn, mid-September, they voted to approve it, and it went into effect October 1st. The bans I have seen throughout the country, you know, there's been plenty at the local level. I've never seen one that aggressive, to give them no time whatsoever. Mm. And so a group of landscape professionals brought litigation against the town of Montclair for many things, but one of them was this concept of preemption. And that's what's very interesting to us. And so it's on appeal right now. It's in the third district of the federal third district, meaning if we were to win, this preemption notion would probably push a lot of these bans to the side for a little while, which is what we think is good for the industry while we continue to help move them forward. We are not in it alone. The Equipment Manufacturers Association, the Outdoor Power Equipment Institute, and the Tree Can Industry Association also filed amicus brief with us. So it's always good to be working with some of our great partner associations.
Right. Well, we got it. This has been fantastic. We're going to get wrapped up here. If you're an owner and your lawn or pest, like what would you consider to be kind of the very top things that people need to be thinking about? Obviously there's an election year. We talked about that. But I mean, anything you can think of, there's obviously what you've already mentioned, which is make sure you go out and vote, right? It's really important this year that you go out and vote. Anything else you can think of that they should be either advocating for or be involved in, just some quick hit items like, okay, this is how you can get involved. This is how you can help.
Sure, sure. Well, obviously, please make sure you're getting the advocate every Friday from me. Please make sure you're staying informed, educated. If you want to be more engaged, and happy to put you in our advocacy contact team, which means these are folks to get notices when something's going on in their state. But from just a business owner perspective, and you guys give great advice to so many people that listen to you, the thing that I'm learning more and more as I'm getting into these fights or battles or whatever you want to call it on behalf of the industry, whether it be water or equipment or even recruiting and H2B and whatever, embrace technology. Don't be afraid of it. Because I believe those that are early adopters to new trends actually have a competitive advantage in our marketplace. And I do think as we continue to evolve forward, we're going to do everything again to help make that transition. And maybe instead of always fighting everything, we can start supporting things to give more tax credits or incentives. And so that's really what I would like to focus some of our time on. And trust me, we're still always going to be going to battle and defending your ability to use whatever you want. But what I have noticed is some of the companies that are embracing innovation and change quicker, I think have an advantage.
Yeah, profit is definitely in the change. Dan, any parting thoughts before we finish out here?
No, I think that was excellent. I think we'll have you back.
Try
to keep track of this stuff. I think it's important for everybody in the industry to be on top of this.
Yeah. Hey, let's not wait 4 years next time. I'd love to come after the election and tell you what I think.
No, we had no idea that this podcast would last.
We did not. And to be fair, I was like, 2020? What? So anyway, but no. And one more thing I'll add before we finish out here, which is just for our listeners, don't think for a moment that you don't have a big impact. We here in North Carolina years ago, we had a service tax that was coming. And a lot of our guys in our association and gals went and talked to their local representatives, and we got a carve out because of that. And so, you know, a simple call to your local rep, a simple meeting, if you can get it, it actually does matter. So don't think for a moment that that you can't make a difference, because you absolutely can. And, you know, believe it or not, in our case, I truly believe the reason that we got the carve out was because in our case, a lot of folks from our association went out and talked to, you know, their district rep and those types of things. So with that, just a reminder that all the resources and topics that we talked about today are available on the podcast website, pnpindustryinsider.com. Just take a look under show notes. We'll link up stuff that we talked about here. We'll make sure that if you want to get involved, we can do that. And we'll try to get, maybe, can we get a copy, Andrew, can we get maybe a copy of this advocate, or at least where people can sign up, maybe a link for that as well?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. We'll make sure we get that as well. And with that, if you enjoy the show or enjoyed this episode, we always ask that you please give us a good positive rating. Any complaints, concerns, and just general complaining in general, we ask that you direct that to Dan. And with that, we're all going to sign out. We'll see you all next time. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
See ya.